Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're plunging into stories that, well, really test the limits of the human spirit. Today, we're taking a shortcut to some profound insights from a really powerful memoir. It's called Betrayal and Blessings, a true story of faith, friendship, and survival.
It's quite a title, and it lives up to it.
Yeah, our mission in this deep dive is to unpack the incredible depths of human nature, its capacity for deceit, definitely, but also for just extraordinary resilience, unwavering faith, and something really central here, the remarkable loyalty of animals.
That's right. We're looking at how one person navigated just profound betrayal and really emerged stronger.
We're drawing from the dedication, the preface, intro, various chapters.
Yeah.
Basically getting a full picture.
And it offers so much more than just a, you know, a gripping story. It's a deep exploration of personal transformation. It reveals how incredible strength, even grace, can come out of unimaginable suffering.
Okay, so let's set the stage. Let's rewind. Take a deep breath with us back to the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
The memoir paints this picture of a life that was, well, by all counts, pretty idyllic. Mm-hmm. Our narrator lived in a small, close-knit community, a place defined by simplicity, a real sense of contentment.
Yeah, days had this sort of gentle, predictable rhythm, you know, work, family, friendship, pretty normal on the surface.
And absolutely central, right at the heart of that home, were six incredible canine companions.
Oh, yeah. Shadow, the Australian Shepherd, majestic, intelligent, watchful, just sounds like an amazing dog.
Totally. And then the five black dogs. There was Ink, the playful one.
Yeah.
Midnight, quiet, contemplative. Cole, the gentle giant. Onyx, the alert guardian. And Phantom, who was endearingly shy.
It's quite the pack.
It really is. And what strikes you reading this is how the narrator talks about their role. These weren't just pets. They were confidants, protectors.
Really?
Family members.
Absolutely. And woven into all this was the narrator's quiet, deep-seated spirituality. It wasn't showy, just part of daily life, giving this constant sense of peace and strength.
But as the memoir foreshadows pretty early on, beneath all that apparent tranquility, a current of deception was silently swirling.
Yeah, that current started to show up through these almost imperceptible shifts. Tiny cracks in a lifelong friendship with someone named Sarah.
Sarah. Okay. What kind of shifts are we talking about?
Well, the narrator noticed Sarah's whole demeanor changed. Missed calls, vague excuses for canceling plans, a guarded look, maybe avoiding eye contact, whispered conversations, and interestingly, a real agitation whenever the dogs were around.
That's telling. Especially the dog part.
It really wasn't the friend the narrator knew. Something was definitely off.
So how did the animals react? You mentioned they were agitated around her. They must have picked up on something before the narrator even consciously clocked it all.
That's exactly it. Their role became undeniable pretty quickly. The memoir highlights how acutely sensitive they were. Shadow, for instance, he'd direct this unwavering vigilance right at Sarah, sometimes a low growl, hackles raised. And Ink, usually the playful one, became subdued around her. Whimpering, seeking reassurance from the narrator. It was like they could, I don't know, literally sense the shift in energy, the deception underneath.
It's chilling. And then it wasn't just Sarah acting weird, right?
What?
Other things started happening.
Exactly. It started stacking up. The narrator mentions overhearing this hushed phone conversation. The tone wasn't just urgent. It had this edge of malice. It sent this wave of dread through her.
Oh.
And on top of that, small things started disappearing from the house. Seemingly insignificant things, a favorite pen, an old antique box, a cherished photo, not huge losses individually, but together. They added to this growing, pervasive unease.
And it spread beyond just Sarah, didn't it? The memoir talks about a shift in the whole community.
Yes, that's a crucial point. Friends started acting differently. There were hushed conversations, averted gazes, a subtle coolness, as the book puts it.
So the community, which should have been a source of support.
Right, went from being this protective embrace to feeling more like a cage tightening around her. This just intensified the isolation, tested her faith, profoundly made it waver, actually. And it even started showing up physically.
How so?
Persistent headaches. Stomach aches, sleepless nights filled with really vivid dreams. It wasn't just the direct betrayal, but this creeping sense of abandonment from everyone that really started to wear her down.
So with this tension escalating, her vulnerability increasing, how did the dogs step up their warnings? They were already sensing so much.
Well, this is where we get to their truly critical early warnings.
Mm.
Their protective instincts went into overdrive. Shadow would consistently, deliberately place himself between the narrator and Sarah growling. The black dogs would form this protective circle like a barrier. They clearly saw Sarah as a direct threat.
But it went beyond just general protectiveness, didn't it? The book shares specific instances that were genuinely life-saving.
Oh, absolutely. There's one story where Shadow's insistent barking at a locked cupboard. It led the narrator to check, and she found the lock had been tampered with. It prevented a potential break-in.
Incredible.
And even more dramatically, Ink, the playful one, just refused to move near the car one day. Flat out refused. It made the narrator investigate, and she discovered a loose wire near the fuel tank.
No way. That could have been
an explosion, yeah. The memoir really emphasizes these weren't just, you know, typical dog behaviors. They were silent protectors, guardians, a vital early warning system. It describes it as almost supernatural intuition that literally saved her life multiple times, a subconscious warning system.
So the signs were escalating, the dogs were clearly agitated, and then it all came to a head on that terrible night, the night of the attack. What was the atmosphere like right before it happened?
You could feel it. The air was just heavy with dread. And significantly, Sarah, the supposed friend, was conveniently nowhere to be found. A strange quiet had settled over the house, just the clock ticking, the wind outside. But the dogs, they were anything but quiet. Shadow was pacing restlessly. The black dogs were huddled together. Their anxiety was palpable. They knew something was coming.
And then the storm broke.
Yes. Sharp, insistent pounding on the door. Immediately, the dogs just erupted. Frenzied barks, growls. Shadow launched himself towards the door, acting like this fierce protector. The black dogs formed what the book calls a snarling protective barrier right around the narrator.
Zinger, it gives way.
It splintered. An attacker burst in, just a figure shrouded in shadow, radiating menace. There was a stench of alcohol, something metallic. The attack was swift, brutal. A blow to the narrator's head, the flash of a weapon.
Oh, God.
And then this horrifying sound, a guttural cry of pain from one of the dogs. It's just harrowing to even read about.
But even then, in that chaos, the dogs fought back.
Unbelievably heroic. Shadow engaged in what's described as a desperate struggle, literally acting as a human-sized shield. Ink, Diesel, the others, they surrounded me, protecting me, even as they themselves were being attacked.
How did it stop?
It was the dogs. Their frantic barking, their defense. It led to a moment where the attacker cried out, a searing, sharp pain in his leg, a scream, and then sudden silence. The assault was over.
The aftermath must have been devastating.
Brutal. The narrator describes waking up to excruciating pain. Her body, the book says, was a tapestry of bruises and cuts. And the dogs, her protectors, they were injured too.
How badly?
Shadow had a deep laceration. Ink's leg was clearly broken. Diesel had a deep gash. The others had multiple wounds. They'd put themselves in the line.
And adding insult to injury, Sarah was still conveniently absent.
Exactly. Deepening that chilling loneliness, the despair, and then the emergency services, the hospital staff, while efficient, they're described as impersonal, detached. It just deepened that sense of profound isolation.
But the dogs.
Even injured, they remained her steadfast companions, a beacon of love and unwavering loyalty. Truly her source of strength in that overwhelming trauma.
So, immense trauma. But her gut feelings screamed conspiracy, right? Yet the police.
Yeah, the initial investigation led by an officer Miller is described as perfunctory, almost dismissive. They filed it as a simple home invasion. Despite the obvious brutality, the clear premeditation.
What did she do, faced with that official dismissal?
It just fueled her determination. She started her own detective work, meticulously examining the crime scene herself. She found details the police missed locks that were meticulously picked, not forced. The placement of broken glass suggested someone with intimate knowledge of my property.
Oh, this is definitely not random.
No way.
So she needed allies. Who did she turn to?
The memoir introduces some local contacts and, crucially, a retired detective named Mr. Henderson. He was skeptical at first, but he started seeing the inconsistencies the official investigation ignored. Lack of forced entry, the specific targeting of the dogs, the precision of it all.
He saw the pattern.
Exactly. And these allies started uncovering some unsettling things, connecting the dots.
What kind of things?
Well, a neighbor, Mrs. Gable, remembered seeing a dark-colored SUV near the house around that time, suggesting surveillance. And she linked it somehow to local real estate transactions.
Real estate.
Oh. That led them to a local business owner, Mr. Evans. Turns out he'd been pressured by a big local businessman, a Mr. Silas Thorne. Thorne was known for ruthless business tactics, aggressive land acquisitions. He'd even made veiled threats against Evans's family.
Ah, so Thorne emerges as the prime suspect.
Yes. Evidence started pointing to a calculated conspiracy to amass land by any means necessary. The investigation got reopened, armed with this new irrefutable evidence, and it uncovered this whole web of deceit and collusion.
Involving who? Just Thorne?
No, it was Thorne, his lawyers, real estate agents, even a local council member. A broad, insidious conspiracy.
Just when you think it can't get any worse.
Right. As if that wasn't enough, the whole ordeal took this new, absolutely surreal turn. Accusations of witchcraft started flying around.
Witchcraft? Seriously, how did that even start?
The community's whispers, fueled by fear and maybe superstition, morphed into these chilling accusations. They tried to reframe the meticulous crime as some kind of dark magic.
It's astonishing how fear twists things. So her resilience, her fight for justice, that got turned against her.
Precisely. It was a desperate attempt to scapegoat her. She became this convenient target in a community already grappling with fear and superstition, which the memoir notes was sort of deeply embedded in the cultural fabric there.
Were the claims specific? Or just general fear-mongering?
No, they were specific and outlandish. Accusations of cursing Thorne, that her dogs were familiar spirits, that she practiced black magic. All circumstantial, the book says, completely lacking factual evidence. But it fueled speculation, created this really dangerous atmosphere.
Did anyone try to push back?
Authority.
Other community members.
The community got divided. Authorities apparently struggled. How do you counter that kind of narrative without accidentally validating it by giving it too much airtime? It left the narrator totally ostracized, vulnerable, feeling like both a victim and a pariah.
How did this impact her faith, that core strength?
It pushed it to the absolute limit. She questioned how a just and compassionate God could allow such blatant injustice. But ultimately, the memoir is clear. Her faith did not break, which shows incredible inner fortitude.
So then came the legal battles, the Thorne case. The courtroom became, well, more than just about facts.
Absolutely. A battleground not just for facts and evidence, but for perceptions. Incredibly, the prosecution actually introduced irrelevant testimony about the bizarre rumors of supernatural abilities, even with her lawyer objecting.
The judge allowed that.
The judge apparently allowed what was termed relevant community context, which just blurred the lines completely. It turned into a kind of trial by public opinion.
So the defense had to change strategy.
Drastically. They had to address the witchcraft stuff head on, bring in character witnesses, make logical counterarguments. It was described as completely exhausting and frustrating.
What was the final verdict after all that?
It was termed a qualified victory. Thorne and his associates found guilty, assault, conspiracy. But importantly, no evidence was found for any of the witchcraft accusations.
So some validation. But at a huge cost.
Huge cost. The memoir makes it clear the legal battles left deep scars, physical, emotional, a profound loss of trust, not to mention the financial burden.
What an absolutely immense ordeal, that first betrayal. You'd hope, you'd think, after surviving that, the worst must be over.
You'd think so.
But the memoir reveals there was another storm coming, wasn't there?
It does. Fast forward about 17 years to 2017, the narrator faced a new kind of betrayal, just as devastating in its own way. The narrative shifts to the unraveling of her marriage.
Oh no, how did that start?
It began subtly in spring 2017. She noticed what she calls the insidious creep of a shadow, a gradual chipping away at the foundation of a relationship I had believed to be unshakable.
How did it progress?
By the fall of 2017, her husband's absences were more frequent, his explanations vague. His lies became, as the book puts it, careless, almost blatant.
The emotional toll must have been immense. Again.
Huge. She writes about needing to pour out her heart to God, to close friends, family. And of course, this led inevitably to more arduous legal battles. This time, divorce.
Navigating that legal minefield. Divorce is always complex, but after what she'd been through.
Incredibly draining. Financial entanglements, property disputes, dividing assets. The petition for divorce filed by her husband is described as this cold legal statement marking the official end.
And the process itself.
It involved what lawyers call a protracted process of discovery. Basically, a long, drawn-out legal dance. Gathering extensive financial documents, every bank statement, tax return, investment portfolio laid bare.
And emotionally.
There was an exchange of communications where the husband actually tried to cast doubt on my own character. Adding another layer of cruelty. Imagine having to meticulously appraise and divide items with deep sentimental value. It felt like another layer of loss.
Did she have support through this?
Thankfully, yes. She mentions her lawyer was very empathetic, a crucial source of strength and guidance, helping her navigate the chaos. The final decree of divorce, when it came, was a profound loss, naturally, but also a necessary closure. Those documents became, in a way, a record of my strength and resilience. And all that stress, the divorce proceedings, it took a huge physical toll too.
Right, the body keeps the score.
Yeah.
What does the memoir say about that?
Her medical records become part of the story. They chronicle the physical manifestations. Relentless insomnia, significant weight loss, constant exhaustion, frequent debilitating migraines, persistent stomach problems. It's a stark reminder of that mind-body connection.
Did she get professional help for that side of things?
Yes, that was key. She mentions a Dr. Eleanor Vance meticulously documenting these physical changes, and a therapist, Dr. Marcus Klein, focused on processing the shock, managing stress, reducing anxiety. He used techniques like CBT cognitive behavioral therapy,
which helps change negative thought patterns.
Exactly. And mindfulness practices, focusing on the present moment. She also turned to alternative therapies like yoga, found it calming, stress-reducing, and the community aspect was helpful, too. It genuinely improved her physical and mental health.
So the medical records weren't just tracking illness.
No, they became, as she puts it, a chronicle of my journey through trauma and healing, really highlighting that profound link between physical and emotional well-being.
The memoir also uses this idea of visual evidence conceptually, which sounds really powerful. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's a compelling technique. She describes a before photo, this grainy, poorly lit shot from the early legal stuff. She's hunched over a stack of legal documents, just radiating exhaustion and anxiety. A raw, unfiltered snapshot of vulnerability.
And the after.
It's contrasted with a photo taken months later, a more deliberate composition. She's in a yoga class, bathed in soft light, looking serene, her breathing regulated. It visually represents the healing, the transformation.
That's powerful. Are there other examples?
Mm-hmm. She mentions redacted medical notes showing the weight changes, the frequency of insomnia, even excerpts from emails, hurried sentences, an anxious tone. They all serve as these little visual timelines of her journey. It really shows, rather than just tells, the impact. And the emotional trauma itself. It was immense, a torrent of emotions, she calls it. Fear, anger, self-blame, that profound sense of betrayal again. The world felt menacing and unpredictable. Sounds, shadows could trigger panic.
How did she even begin to navigate that, to quiet the triggers?
Therapy was crucial. Dr. Vance's guidance led to breakthroughs, particularly using EMDR.
Eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
That's the one. It helps fade the vividness and intensity of traumatic memories. It reduced the nightmares, the flashbacks. Mindfulness techniques were also vital for grounding her in the present, stopping her from being constantly trapped in the past.
What does the memoir say about the healing process itself? Is it straightforward?
Not at all. A key insight is that healing is not linear. She acknowledges setbacks. Perseverance was absolutely key. And throughout all this, her spiritual solace remained vital. Prayer, reading the Psalms, scripture, they became a daily comfort. Plus, the community at her church, St. Jude's Elder Martha, Thomas, they rallied with unwavering support. Practical help, prayers, just being there.
And the animals, again, their loyalty must have been indispensable during this second storm, too.
Absolutely indispensable. While the earlier dogs were part of the first trauma, this section emphasizes the continued importance of animals. She introduces new companions, Barnaby, a boisterous Labrador, and Sasha, a stoic German shepherd. They provided comfort after the attack and right through the divorce. It shows that bond endures.
Are there specific examples of their comfort?
Oh, yes. She recounts one time during a violent storm, she was terrified, and Barnaby and Sasha just came and settled right beside her. Their physical presence quelled the fear. They also just knew when she was in intense emotional turmoil, offering silent companionship, that unconditional love. It's a profound gift.
It really sounds like their loyalty went beyond just instinct.
It truly did. It reflected the deep bond they shared. She poured out her joys and sorrows to them. The biggest takeaway, animals are integral parts of our families, sources of comfort and joy, and often are silent therapists. Companionship, affection, purpose, stress reduction, it's all there. It reminds you healing isn't just about human connection.
So let's pull back and look at the key themes, the tools for resilience that emerge from this whole story. Faith is obviously huge, but what's maybe a surprising insight about its role here? It wasn't just passive comfort, was it?
No, not at all. That's what really stands out. Her faith wasn't static. It evolved. It went from that quiet background spirituality to something much more active, almost like a fierce dialogue. The memoir shows that questioning God, wrestling with injustice, isn't weakness. It can actually be the crucible for a deeper, more resilient connection.
That's powerful.
It's an often overlooked aspect of spiritual endurance, I think. Prayer became less routine, more a genuine dialogue, a wrestling with God's will. Scripture, especially Psalms and Gospels, hit differently, resonated with new depth. She even explored theological ideas like forgiveness not condoning, but a self-liberation, and kenosis.
Self-emptying.
Right? Letting go of resentment, that really resonated with her. And the church community, Elder Martha, Thomas, Pastor Sarah Miller, they were that unshakable anchor, offering unwavering support, prayers, practical help. It bolstered her resolve. Faith gave her the moral compass to seek justice, but always, importantly, tempered with compassion.
Beyond faith, the memoir highlights very practical tools for healing, too.
Yes, definitely. Conscious self-care. Prioritizing sleep hygiene, making sure sleep was restorative. Mindful eating, focusing on nutrient-dense foods. Consistent exercise, yoga, running, just walks in nature. Oh. All aimed at managing stress, improving mood, restoring that physical balance.
And creative outlets.
Crucial. Painting, especially, she notes how her palette shifted from somber tones to vibrant ones over time. And journaling, both described as cathartic experiences, ways to process emotions, and reclaim a sense of agency.
What about boundaries? That seems important after betrayal.
Absolutely. Learning to say no, protecting her energy, her emotional well-being, cultivating relationships built on mutual respect. It's an often underestimated tool in healing, setting those healthy boundaries.
And connecting with others who understood.
Yes, she found immense strength in a women's support group. That shared experience, the empathy, mutual encouragement, it was vital for breaking the isolation. Mm. It really highlights the power of shared vulnerability. Then there's the whole process of forgiveness, which the memoir tackles head on.
And it's not about letting people off the hook, right?
Not at all. It makes that crystal clear. Forgiveness, whether for others or for oneself, isn't about excusing actions. It's about releasing the burden of resentment and anger. It's for your liberation, achieving self-liberation.
But it's not easy.
No, it's described as a long, arduous process. It takes conscious effort and, importantly, self-compassion, acknowledging imperfections without beating yourself up. Ultimately, she made a conscious choice to rewrite her narrative.
How so?
Shifting from victimhood to empowerment, defining herself not by the betrayals, but by her response to them. The scars are still there, yes, but they become badges of honor, testaments to my resilience, markers of growth, not just wounds of pain.
What an absolutely incredible journey. From those depths of, frankly, unimaginable betrayal and suffering, she emerged into a place of peace, purpose, real resilience.
Her story powerfully demonstrates that healing isn't some final destination you arrive at. It's a continuous evolution. It's a profound testament to the human spirit's capacity for transformation, especially when it's buoyed by things like unwavering faith, compassion, and the steadfast support of loved ones, including, absolutely, our incredible animal companions.
So the question for you listening might be, how could understanding this profound human capacity for transformation, this ability to find strength even in ashes, how might that guide you through your own challenges? How might it help reshape your story? It's definitely something worth reflecting on.